You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, March 17th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Assistant Professor of Political Science, Director of the African American Studies Department at University of Detroit Mercy, Alex Zamlin, on his book, Against Civility, Hidden Racism in Our Obsession with Civility. Meanwhile, eight dead in three Atlanta massage parlors, FBI investigating for possible Asian hate crime. Joe Biden comes out in support of the filibuster reform. Trump administration reportedly pushed Brazil to reject Russia's vaccine. U.S. COVID infections may have been twice the number reported. All this as new hotspots emerge in the upper Midwest and the New York City area. Biden, in an interview, urges migrants to stay home and orders a gag rule on the Border Patrol. Meanwhile, FEMA head says migrant COVID rate lower than Texans. 72% of Americans approve of the $1.9 trillion COVID relief bill as elected Republicans reel in its wake. Internal memos apparently show the Obama administration Justice Department completely bungled a Google antitrust case. The state attorney generals in Republican states threatened to sue the federal government as the COVID relief bill had a provision that said its state and municipal funding can't be used to finance tax cuts. And lastly, Medicare for All bill drops in the House. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us Wednesday. Emma Vigeland is here. Sadly, she has deprived everyone of our traditional Wednesday white shirt day. White Shirt Wednesday.
Abbreviate it.
White Shirt Wednesday. That is one of the provisions of White Shirt Wednesday, is that you don't necessarily have to wear a white shirt.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense to people, but that's kind of how we celebrate White Shirt Wednesday. I considered wearing a white sweater, and I thought it best to rebel against you, my boss.
Yes, well, all right, I appreciate that. I mean, of course, I didn't send out an edict in any way that you had to. Well, all right. I mean, it's there was a veiled threat. There was a veiled threat that was put out company-wide. You probably saw the sign at the commissary today.
Yes. You held a compulsory meeting and said, I'm not saying you have to wear a white shirt. I'm just saying.
And if you did wear a white shirt, you have gotten the bonus two custards at the end of the line at the on the commissary. We were giving out the extra custards to everyone. We're still waiting on more information out of this situation in Atlanta. Horrible, horrible shooting. Six of the eight, as it's reported now, and these things always seem to evolve. Six of the eight victims were Asian women. It is very hard not to see this in the context of the really stunning increase in Asian American hate crimes that we have seen over the course of, over the course of the year, frankly. And, you know, I think very often there are theoretically secondary motives here, but when you realize this is not that someone made a decision to go some specific place and shoot people and kill them, sometimes all you need to do is, you know, look at the names of the victims and look at the or maybe the you know, the faces of victims and get a sense of what at least partially what was going through the killer's mind, or what the killer you know, what was not stopping him. So you know, there's more reporting to be done. Supposedly some of the police who have interviewed him are suggesting that it was a function of,
well, what he said to them was that it was a function of his sex addiction. We don't know if he went to these specific massage parlors or if he had gone to massage parlors in the past. But either way, there's a racial element to it, even if he's claiming it's not racially motivated. Just kind of the nature of that aspect of sex work has racial implications as well, based on the massage parlors that he targeted. So we're learning more information. It may not reach the threshold of he had a manifesto that documented it as a hate crime, but there are certainly racially hateful elements embedded in the targets of his murderous rampage.
Yeah, a really horrible story. We will keep an eye on that. In the meantime, last night, Joe Biden was interviewed. Was it on CBS News? I believe it was.
ABC with George Stephanopoulos.
ABC with George Stephanopoulos. And he, there was a couple of things he was asked about that are pretty relevant that we will probably get to over the course of the program. But in terms of furthering the Democratic agenda, be that as it may, Joe Biden was asked, and really not just about, frankly, about making the Senate a somewhat more Democratic institution. I mean, it is structurally impossible to make it a genuinely Democratic, small d Democratic institution, because, of course, you have the same vote, weight of a vote accorded to someone who represents hundreds of thousands of people as the vote of someone who represents millions of people. Doesn't make any sense. That's the Senate, though. And here's Joe Biden asked about a lot of things, but the one of the key things is, what is his perspective on the filibuster?
If we just took the tax rate back to what it was when Bush was president, top rate paid 39.8%, 6% in federal taxes, that would raise $230 billion. Yet they're complaining because I'm providing a tax credit for child care, for the poor, for the middle class, keeping people. And by the way, my proposal in the relief plan I put forward, it creates 7 million jobs, according to a whole range of people, including Moody's on Wall Street, number one, increases the GDP by over $1 trillion, actually raises income in America and diminishes debt in America. I mean, what are these guys talking about?
By your own admission, just say you're not likely to get Republican votes for the tax increase. You're not likely to get Republican votes for H.R. 1, expanding voting rights, or the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. So aren't you going to have to choose? I know you've been reluctant to do away with the filibuster. Aren't you going to have to choose between preserving the filibuster and advancing your agenda?
Yes. But here's the choice. I don't think you have to eliminate the filibuster. You have to do it what it used to be when I first got to the Senate and back in the old days when you used to be around there. And that is that a filibuster, you had to stand up and command the floor. And you had to keep talking alone. You couldn't call for, you know, no one could say, you know, quorum call. Once you stopped talking, you lost that, and someone could move in and say, I move the question of. So you got to work for the filibuster.
So you're for that reform. You're for bringing back the talking filibuster.
I am. That's what it was supposed to be. Look, I think, don't hold me to the numbers, George, but I think between 1960 and 2000, there were, I'm making this number up, I don't know. There were like, you know, 50 filibusters. And now they're like 200 since then. Since that
just put a hold
changed.
On it, that's it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, so the idea, it almost is getting to the point where there's, you know, democracy's having a hard time functioning. A hard time functioning. And so, look, I'm not saying this is going to be easy, George. But I do believe there's enough Republicans over time who are going to have, look,
they haven't had that epiphany you said you were going to see in the campaign.
No, well, I've only been here 6 weeks, pal. Okay, give me a break. Been here 6 weeks. I think the epiphany is going to come in between now and 2022. This is one. There's 78% of the people say they support this program. 52% of Republicans. Let's assume it's off by 15%. You're going to go home and campaign. Republican voters want that $1,500 because they're in trouble. Republican voters 14. Want to be able to choose between being able to go to work and send their kid to a daycare that they can afford. Republican voters want
to. All right.
Be able
well,
to
I think we get the gist here. I mean, yeah. Let's put aside for a moment the clinging to this delusion that Republican lawmakers will.
Yeah,
will
don't
come
hold
around.
Your breath, Joe.
But you know, and with that said, if he I am perfectly happy for him to have that delusion if it doesn't inhibit him from coming out and saying what he said about the filibuster. I mean,
or if it's just lip service in order to get people like George Stephanopoulos, who keep asking about Republican support, off of his back, even though this isn't in keeping with Biden's obsession with appeasing Republicans.
Totally
in the past,
agree.
At least.
Totally agree. In fact, yep. I would argue it is if it does not control what you do in terms of the filibuster, it is actually a very smart thing to do because it creates an expectation. You know, I'm a reasonable guy and I'm expecting them to come by here. And if the Republicans don't show up with votes, which they won't, then they're being unreasonable, as it were. But let's talk about this filibuster thing, because this is huge.
Huge.
And, you know, others have made this point. It would be very hard to imagine a Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren, for that matter, or frankly, really anybody in the Democratic field to be able to move their the Democrats in the Senate in a 50-50 tie to essentially defang the filibuster. It's still, I mean, it allows you to slow things down. It's going to make it hard to move things forward, but there's actually a path as opposed to what we have now. The fact that when he talks about from 1960 to year 2000, there were only 50 filibusters. I actually think there was less. But he was literally in the Senate.
Well, he has the credibility because he was elected in 72, and then
for 30
I guess
of those years.
In 75, that was when the 60 vote threshold was implemented.
From 67,
sorry,
and from 67, the Senate just didn't filibuster as much. They just didn't. They just said, like, look. We're going to respect that the majority wants this. I'm going to try and slow it down. I'm going to try and register my extreme opposition to this, but that's it. I'm going to register my extreme opposition. I'm not going to sink it. And now I don't know if, you know, I can't get into Joe Biden's head, but at the very least, that is he goes to Joe Manchin. He goes to Kristen Sinema. He goes to anybody who calls himself a Senate institutionalist and says, you're talking to the biggest Senate institutionalist.
Right.
I see your Senate institutionalism and I raise it. And you cannot in any way argue against that.
Well, yeah, I agree. And I mean.
And so he goes, he has a compelling case. If he says, like, look, this is not the way it was done before. What we're doing now, what we see now is actually an affront to the institution of the Senate. Now, look, I don't know if that's the case or not. I mean, leave that to historians. But the point is, that's the argument he can make. And the implications of this are not just that we're going to carve out something for H.R. 1. The implications of it are that there's going to be more potential for more bills. Now, understand, Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema are going to rule the day under this situation. Because if it is just a standard operating procedure that you're not going to have to worry about the filibuster at the end of the day. They're going to leverage this, but it's going to mean some activity, and it's going to mean a difference even when Republicans get into office and when they control the Senate. It's going to mean they're going to be held responsible for what they do on some level.
Yeah. And I think, look, to your point about if Bernie Sanders were president, I think he would have fought in different ways and he would not have this kind of more tweaking within the system mentality, as he would have a more holistic, substantive overhaul of the corruption and the procedures that have held us back for so long. So obviously I voted for Bernie Sanders, would rather Bernie Sanders be president. But what we're seeing right now is like in the 80th percentile of the best case scenario of what Joe Biden could have been in these first 2 months of being president, right? Which is, he is being pushed. I mean, people are glib about, could Biden be pushed to the left? He was pushed on this issue, this very issue. He's now in favor of the talking filibuster, which is basically saying that you are in favor of overhauling the filibuster to the point where it really can't stop certain kinds of legislation. That's massive. Manchin was pushed on this issue. We need to see what Sinema was pushed on. But even the $1.9 trillion relief bill, he was pushed there. And I think it's key to point that out. McConnell's now saying if they do this, he'll do a scorched earth campaign. And then you have Dick Durbin saying, well, this is what you already did.
Right.
There's no more arrows in their quiver, to borrow your phrase that's now in my head because we spent so much time together. There's no more credibility there for McConnell to say that he will threaten these things when he's emptied all of his arrows at the Democrats over the past
absolutely
many years.
That's the thing. You can't threaten to go to scorch the earth once you've already burnt it. And so it's going to be fascinating to see where we go from here. We got to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Alex Zamelin on his book Against Civility: Hidden Racism in Our Obsession with Civility. Be right back after this. Folks, just a reminder, your support makes this show possible. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com. It is your memberships that keep this show alive. You will support the free half and you will get no commercials in the free half when we do have commercials. And then you get the fun half. So and then we're working on an app upgrade for bonuses in the app. We're working on that as well for members. But now I'd like to welcome to the program Assistant Professor of Political Science, Director of the African American Studies Program at the University of Detroit Mercy, author of Against Civility: Hidden Racism in Our Obsession with Civility, Alex Zamelin. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Great to be here, Sam.
Thanks. And I'm here, obviously, with Emma Vigeland. And really timely. I mean, I know that you wrote most of this book prior to even this summer of protests. And I would say, like, we have, and obviously prior to what happened on January 6th. And frankly, you know, I think some of this like applies. I'm holding off on asking this sort of like broader meta question of you. I'm trying to hold that back, but I feel like this understanding of how these calls for civility function has incredible relevance right now. But what was it that inspired you to write this? You've written a couple other books. What was it that had you focus on this really sort of, I guess, intellectual history of the deployment of the term, the concept of civility?
Yeah. Well, I think the first thing that struck me around the 2018 midterms was the way that the Democratic Party began to recruit calls for civility in order to pose a challenge to Trump. And what struck me at first was I thought, surely this is a problematic strategy given the deep history of civility being used by right-wing forces. But it was only when I started to actually dig deep into the long history that I started to see that civility has always been used in a deeply troubling way to disauthorize democratic movements and to justify repression and violence, specifically against people of color. So the text that I really began the book with was John C. Calhoun, who is a defender of the slaveholding class. And he gives this remarkable speech. It's stunning. In 1837, he goes in front of the Senate floor. And just as William Lloyd Garrison is convening 300,000 abolitionists to protest slavery, Calhoun, the defender of the slaveholding class, says the real problem in the United States is these uncivil abolitionists. They're tearing the country apart. We need them to back down. But more importantly, we need to continue the slaveholding policies of the past several hundred years. And so that to me was a real insight into how the term becomes circulated at first. And when I saw Democrats using it in 2018, I was confused and shocked, and even more so once I learned about the history.
Well, so how do you explain that paradox? I mean, and this is the thing that's sort of fascinating to me about this term. And I want to go through, obviously, there are certain moments in history where this term is deployed and what it means at that moment. But how do you explain that paradox that presumably Biden is deploying the concept of civility against someone who has Trump clearly benefited from and stoked racism, pre-existing racism, and then sort of just like, I don't know, there was a feedback loop on some level. And I mean, how do you reconcile that paradox?
Yeah, I think that there's an asymmetry between the left and the right, or moderate Democrats and the right throughout history, which is Democrats consistently want to reach across the aisle. You see this time and time again. Think Lincoln in the late 1850s trying to make compromises. He goes so far as to say colonization is okay. This is a program sponsored by racists, but the idea of exporting black citizens to the African continent is something that Lincoln endorses because he thinks it's a way to reach some kind of compromise. In 1996, Clinton tries to cut welfare because he wants to continue to compromise. I think that liberals or centrist Democrats believe that conversation is something that could lead to justice. They believe compromise is something that is effective for this end. But the right historically knows that civility is an incredibly powerful tool to be weaponized and used to silence any kind of democratic movements.
Do you think that that contributed to the perception that Donald Trump was the truth teller, too? Because in 2016, he had higher trustworthy numbers than Hillary Clinton going into the election, because the Democratic Party was so focused on being buttoned up and being civil while Donald Trump was shooting from the hip. And it allowed there to be this perception that the Republicans, who lie all the time, took away from the Democrats that they were the ones that were being more honest to the public.
Yeah, I think that that's a really important point, because one of the patterns that I noticed as I was writing this book was that on some level, when Democrats or when the center left parties use civility, they're really trying to come up with a middle ground. And the public understands that there's a lot at stake in white supremacy, racial injustice, violence. The right taps into this and unleashes these powerful negative emotions that the public really can get to understand. I think about 1907, which is the epidemic of the lynching era in the United States. About several thousand Black Americans have already been lynched. And the senator from South Carolina, Pitchfork Ben Tillman, goes in front of the Senate floor and essentially says that lynching isn't only something that is justified, it's necessary. And he taps into this rage and this anger where he says, We're the civil ones. We know how to police black citizens. We know how to engage in this kind of policing of our communities. And it's this terrible, terrible thing, but the right is incredibly adept at using civility in a way to continue their white rage, you know?
Well, let's take this time to sort of define the term for us, or at least define how it's used, because from what I my sense, well, I mean, why don't you do that for us? Like, what does it mean when he says we're the civil ones as we're right. lynching? Right.
Right.
It doesn't necessarily mean like right. we're genteel or something. Right.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, that's what's striking. I mean, civility is one of these terms, and this is why I argue against it. It really depends on who's using it. And the problem is that the right is far more effective at using it for violent ends. So when you see these pictures during the lynching era of white people and children smiling as black bodies are being lynched, they have this understanding that they are the ones who are protecting the honor of women. They're protecting the honor of the community. So in a certain sense, when someone uses civility and says, I'm civil, it really is something that depends on the frame in which they exist, the kind of society that they take to be real and true. And for white supremacists, it is absolutely civil to engage in violent activity if it means defending the honor of white women.
It's as if civility is basically a way of saying the status quo. And in the context of American history, the status quo is so intertwined with systemic racism that it's impossible to think of those two things not as one in this context. I mean, I can imagine a different society maybe right. where right. the notion of civility is, you know, the civil order is such that it isn't contingent right. built upon perpetuating racism, but that's just not our, that's just not us.
Yeah. I think that's an incredible point. I think that one of the things that I noticed as I was writing this book was every single major anti-racist movement and figure, Frederick Douglass, Ida B. Wells, Martin Luther King, even if they embraced civility at the outset of the movement, eventually abandoned it because they recognized exactly what you said, Sam, which is civility and the status quo are deeply linked. And in order to be civil, you need to be tolerant of the status quo.
Tell us about this concept of civic radicalism. Give us a sense of like when you peg this as developing. I mean, where you see it in our history. I mean, you look at this concept of civility from the sort of slave owning time, obviously into Reconstruction, and then Jim Crow, and then into the civil rights era. But give us a sense of how you track civic radicalism.
Yeah, to me, the two are deeply linked. The anti-racist movement that begins in the 19th century, think David Walker, Frederick Douglass, begins to slowly recognize that civility is a losing strategy. So what they come up with instead, and what I call civic radicalism, is the emphasis on disruptive pressure, on speaking out, arguing against the status quo, but even more importantly, organizing in a disruptive way to put concrete pressure on slavery. So I think of W.B. Du Bois' notion of the general strike, which is his understanding of how slavery is toppled, which is black workers, enslaved folks, essentially stop working and they take their labor out of the system and they join up with the Union Army to topple the Confederacy. And so that moment of collective action, disruptive collective action, unapologetic disruptive collective action is what I see as the kind of centerpiece of civic radicalism.
One of my favorite, or maybe my favorite Martin Luther King quote, which I believe you cite in your book, is that he talks about how the greatest stepping block or barrier to progress is not the Ku Klux Klan, but the quote, the white moderate who is more focused on civility and the rules of compromise, right? Can you touch on how that played into really his movement, more specifically this dynamic that you're talking about?
Yeah, one of the things that I had to grapple with as I was writing this book was, how do I think of the civil rights movement, specifically King? Because on the one hand, King vouches for nonviolence, and that's what he's known for throughout history. But one of the things that struck me was in 1962, in December 1962, King is in Albany, Georgia, and he's protesting, and he sees Lori Pritchett, who is the Albany police chief. And what Pritchett does is he kneels in prayer with the civil rights activists, only then to make reporters go to the site where the activists aren't being beaten by police. And this becomes, for King, a recognition that the right knows how to use civility incredibly well. And so at that point, he sees that the idea of staying back, being patient — William Faulkner, the novelist, tells the civil rights activists time and time again, be patient, the South will rise to a better place. King recognizes that that's simply ineffective. And even in I Have a Dream, if you read the speech carefully, he's not only talking about turning the other cheek, he's talking about police brutality. He's talking about systemic racism. That, of course, is silenced in the retelling of his story later on. But King himself knew that civility was an ineffective tactic for countering racial injustice.
I want to get back to that concept of civic radicalism, like the relationship between the civic in the radical, you know, in that term, and the civility. Like this is a redefinition of, on some level, of like of democracy, or a reappropriation of democracy.
Yeah. I think that one of the things I wanted to stress in this history is that part of what these anti-racist activists are doing time and time again is they're challenging the meaning of what a democratic society is. So you take King in 1967, he has a sermon, Where Do We Go From Here?, where he basically starts to articulate a bold critique of the Vietnam War. He starts to call for socioeconomic equality. I think of the Black Panthers in the late 1960s who develop all kinds of programs, food for poor children, loan programs, various kinds of busing programs for those who can't get around town. I mean, this to me is at the root of civic radicalism, because it involves a rethinking of democracy as something that isn't just voting or supporting a political campaign. It is completely changing the structure of who gets to participate and who's free.
Is it your sense that, I mean, and you talk about the sort of, I guess, maybe one of the earliest sort of, you mentioned Frederick Douglass earlier, but the contrast between he and Booker T. Washington. Why don't you just tell us about that? And then I'm curious as to, has this been relearned through as you go through history and there are emancipatory struggles? Has this been relearned each time, or has there been some type of I don't want to say institutional, but some type of memory that because it feels like it's been relearned every time.
Right. I mean, this is one of these dynamics. So Douglass and Washington's position from the beginning of his life till the end was that the way forward was compromise, reconciliation. That's what he basically tells a predominantly white audience at the Atlanta Exposition in 1896. And Douglass's position throughout his life, who is an ex-enslaved man who escapes, he's a fugitive, is struggle, struggle, struggle. And in a certain sense, you see this played out throughout history, which is the conservative strain, which says that picking oneself up by the bootstraps, a kind of rugged individualism, can lead to freedom. And on the other hand, the vision sponsored by Douglass, Ida B. Wells, W.B. Du Bois, which says organization and collective action. To your second question, Sam, I think, yes, I think that there is this deep tendency and desire to believe that civility and reconciliation works. I mean, I'm not sure if it is precisely because the status quo is so entrenched, and it seems like reconstructing it is such a monumental task that it's easier to subscribe to these fantasies of reconciliation and community, or whether it is a kind of strategic concession. That was one interpretation of Washington. The most charitable interpretation of Booker T. Washington was he tried to live within the constraints of a system so that he can navigate a small slice of Black freedom through Tuskegee, through the funding of various colleges. I don't think that that is the effective strategy given the long history we have of civic radical movements, but it's either a strategic compromise or perhaps a recognition of how pervasive systemic racism is in society.
And doesn't the privileging of civility kind of other activists, it makes them seem more alien, more scary.
Right.
It makes progress, it saps it of its natural tension and the beauty in that, almost in how people on the front lines are fighting for progress in via protest. I mean, it's almost conspiratorial in that way, in that it really does sap it of its energy.
Yeah, that is one of the most kind of effective tools of the right. I think at the 2018 senatorial race in Mississippi, when Cindy Hyde Smith against Mike Espy, the Black Democrat, said that, "I love a supporter so much that I would join him at a public hanging." Now, Mississippi literally had the most per capita lynchings compared to any state. So it would make sense that there was an outcry around this statement, calling Cindy Hyde Smith racist, suggesting that she was tapping into the long history of Republicans using race in order to win elections. And yet her response was, it's the activists who are pushing against her that are the violent ones. It's these activists who are on the front lines that are the real menace to society. It's not only Cindy Hyde Smith. I think of several, liberals who decry the way students are toppling these Confederate monuments. And their view is that they're the real threat to freedom in society. This is a consistent theme that we see time and time again.
How much has, what is also striking to me is, our audience knows that I've, become very much sort of almost obsessed with Reconstruction at this point. But what is just constant shock to me is the number of massacres that took place of Black people during Reconstruction that have been completely erased. Wilmington, Hamburg, Opsalousis, I can never pronounce that. Others there. We've spoken prior to Reconstruction. There was a massive burgeoning wealthy class of Black people throughout what was then the Northwest Territories in Ohio, that region, farmers whose property was basically stolen from them through legal means, of course, at that time. But all of these sort of active, I mean, aside, obviously slavery, but once there was, when people were emancipated, when they were making money or they were holding office, there has been these violent, I mean, literally violent, sometimes horrifically violent, uprisings by white people, that were, planned and strategized. And they have been completely erased from our memory. I mean, it's as if if there had been 1,000 Black people who had stormed the Capitol, I feel like we would have a national holiday to recognize that. And I'm not convinced that January 6th in 2 years that anybody's ever going to remember it again. What's happening with that dynamic?
Well, I think one of the things that really was quite striking and stunning as I went to the history of these events that you're describing was how civility was used in almost all of these encounters. So I think of the Wilmington Massacre, 1898. What's striking about it was that you literally had a free Black community that was prosperous, that was essentially taking seriously all of Booker T. Washington's ideas of uplift. So they were practicing the civility that Booker T. was endorsing. And yet the governor of North Carolina, or soon to be governor, then Wilmington mayor, Alfred Waddell, essentially says that white people have every right to come in, storm Wilmington, destroy everything, the newspaper, the press, and leave the city in shambles. Why? Because, and this was the striking quote that I just couldn't get over. Why? Because it was for their own good. White people, in their mind, in a white supremacist society, always assume that they're the civil ones. And they always assume that their acts of violence are justified because they restore the order as it was before. And I gave the example of Ben Tillman, who gives this speech in 1907. This is another important point. Ben Tillman comes to prominence because he literally is involved in a massacre, 1876, with a paramilitary organization called the Red Shirts. They kill six free Black men in Hamburg. And this becomes one of the ways that he rises up in the ranks and gets power. So when we think about Trump and the appeal to violence, that has been integral to the right. The appeal to violence and the restoration of white honor has been central in American history.
When you argue for not falling into that civility trap, and it's also, I guess it's baby cousin of the respectability politics, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that we saw that Barack Obama was, our generation's Booker T. Washington on some level with the respectability politics. When you argue against that, you're not necessarily arguing for violence.
Of course
you're not. It is for what? I mean, right. What does one do when one? It's one thing to say, like, to be aware of this term is being deployed in a certain way, it's being used in a certain way. But in terms of an action, what do you not do?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is a great question. And I think that question itself speaks to the way that we're trapped in our civility thinking, right? As if it's one or the other. To me, civility politics and a civility orientation means that you always stress compromise. You always stress reconciliation. A civic radical politics means you stand up for what you believe in. And the historical pattern is that nonviolent disruptive action, whether it's a boycott, a march, a strike, organization through unions, these are the tactics that have been most successful for anti-racist movements. So I think of the organizing campaign in Bessemer, Alabama, against Amazon. That is part of that legacy. When I think of the Black Lives Matter movement, which is about organizing against police brutality and mass incarceration, that is kind of lockstep with King and his I Have a Dream speech. It's not by any means a defense of violence, precisely because violence leads to more repression. Anytime there has been, as you rightly pointed out, even the potential of Black-led insurrectionary, revolutionary violence, it is stamped out and the police presence is increased by tenfold. So what I'm advocating for is a nonviolent politics of collective action that puts pressure on systems, economic, political, social, in order to push them to change.
And is that effective because it either A, creates the change or forces a backlash that exposes the power dynamic in such a way that changes the minds of people who might be sitting on the sidelines?
I think it's actually both. I think the most important thing is that it allows anti-racist movements and democratic movements to play on their own terms. Because when you use the language of civility, as you pointed out, you're always wrestling with the status quo. You always have to justify your activity within the context of what exists. But with civic radicalism, you're always trying to create a new language, a new kind of strategy that draws in more people. So I think of Bernie's campaign. I think of these kinds of leaders and movements, Occupy, Black Lives Matter, that are trying to bring disaffected citizens in. That's the story of civic radicalism. Rather than reaching across the aisle, you expand your base from those who may not have been interested in politics and may not have even thought that there was a problem to begin with.
But you are advocating at that point, though, with the concept of civic, is maintaining, at the very least, the structures of our democracy. It is just change what happens within the context of those structures.
Right, exactly. It's an idea of change through policy, through legislation, through referendum that leads to a system of equality and justice. But it's certainly working within the system to push the system to realize incredible change. I mean, one of the things that was striking to me was when you look at the labor movement in the 1920s and 1930s, or as you put it, Reconstruction. In 1865, the creation of the Freedmen's Bureau, all of these were inventions of the state of government. You don't need to step outside the system in order to make the system work in a just and democratic fashion. And I think that that is one of the great lessons of American history.
I want to touch on a little bit. Maybe we should have said this before, but where does the notion of normative values play into this? Because I on one hand, I feel like civility is deployed really as just a euphemistic way of saying status quo. And in this country, the status quo is white patriarchy. I mean, it just is. It always has been. I think maybe it's arguably a little bit less than it has been in our past. I mean, I would say definitely a little bit less. But it still is, you know, still look at the old white guy in the off at White House, and he's able to do these things that, that maybe others wouldn't. But where does the normative values come in, and where is it possible to be engaged in civic radicalism and still maintain the normative values, or those normative values need to be shattered as part of that civic radicalism?
Well, I think, you know, I would look back to King, and I think about King's sermons on love. If you read King's sermons on love, he sounds a lot more like Bernie rather than Biden. He's talking about economic redistribution. He's talking about food and benefits for the poor. And so I think that when you're talking about norms for justice and for society, you can resignify, change norms that we already are familiar with, but you can talk about a radical love as opposed to a love of simply caring for the neighbor or praying after a massacre or what have you, that you can find norms within society, whether it's love, hospitality, equality, that speak to a much broader, a more open, a more democratic notion of existence that still matters and is still based in values.
Well, it's a fascinating piece. Alex Zamelin, the book is Against Civility, The Hidden Racism and Our Obsession with Civility. We will put a link to that at majority.fm. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Really
appreciate it. Thank you so much. Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back after this. We're back. We had mentioned earlier that during that interview last night with ABC News, Joe Biden had a couple of news-making moments, I would say. The biggest one from my perspective was his I think, full-throated endorsement for a change in the filibuster, which would allow legislation to pass through. But he also was asked about a major scandal that is brewing in New York State. And, you know, sometimes you talk about New York, we live here, and you hope that you're not being too myopic. But let's face it, New York State could be a place, ultimately, New York State politics are sort of famously corrupt, but could be a place where we see we are on the forefront of progressive legislation. It has not been largely because Andrew Cuomo, for many years, was harboring a great desire to have a national political career and felt that we were living in the 1990s and wanted to prevent himself to have to veto progressive legislation. And so he had essentially midwifed a caucus of Democrats to caucus with Republicans to prevent legislation from hitting his desk that he would have to veto. And now,
yes, among many other corruption issues, and like
he disbanded the Moreland Commission, which was looking into corruption in the state. And when they started looking into him, he disbanded it.
His top aide is in prison right now for corruption. I mean, it's just, the list goes on and on with this guy.
On and on. And the latest two scandals were one that he apparently had advisors who were hiding the number of nursing home deaths in this state because he wanted his leadership book about COVID-19 to really pop. And now there are seven women who have come forward with allegations of sexual harassment. Joe Biden was asked about them last night. This is clip number three.
Let me ask you about Governor Cuomo of New York. I know you've said you want the investigation to continue. If the investigation confirms the claims of the women, should he resign?
Yes, I think he'd probably end up being prosecuted too.
But you, how about right now? You've said you want the investigation to continue. You saw Chuck Schumer, Senator Schumer, Senator Gillibrand, majority of the congressional delegation don't think he can be an effective governor right now. Can he serve effectively?
Well, that's a judgment for them to make about their state where they can be effective. Here's my position. It's been my position since I wrote the Violence Against Women Act. A woman should be presumed to telling the truth and should not be scapegoated and become victimized by her coming forward, number one. But there should be an investigation to determine whether what she says is true. That's what's going on now.
And you've been very clear. If the investigation confirms the claims, he's gone.
That's what I think happens. And by the way, it may very well be there could be a criminal prosecution that is attached to it. I just don't know. But let the investigation. And I'm not, I don't know what it is, but I start with the presumption. It takes a lot of courage for a woman to come forward. Some are not. Anyway, it takes a lot of courage to come forward. So the presumption is it should be taken seriously and it should be investigated. And that's what's underway now.
He has to throw the Violence Against Women Act in there. It's just like he just has this mode that's like compulsive. He has to include that, which by the way, he tied into his notorious crime bill, but I digress.
Thought was interesting was at one moment you saw him hesitate there where he said, you know, women need to be heard now, of course, and then they need to be investigated. And I think that hesitation, I don't know. I mean, I think like obviously there were allegations against him from a woman, Tara Reid. I don't know if they were actually, I mean, to the extent that they were ever criminally investigated, there was not enough evidence that was found at that time. But certainly reporters subsequent to her allegations, reporting that came out sort of much later after the controversy had died down, suggest that she wasn't necessarily She had a history. Let's put it this way. This is, seems incontrovertible. She had a history of lying to other people that she had in her life. Now, not necessarily those type of lies. And Joe Biden did have, I don't know, five or six women who came out and said that they felt that he was getting in their space, but you didn't
well,
have
at the very least that was documented. Like the getting in the space, we have video evidence
absolutely
of him doing that. At the very least he did that. Right. And I just want to make this point because I'm frustrated, that this is the focus though. He should be out based on the cover up of nursing home deaths where he tried to fudge his COVID effectiveness numbers by covering up nearly half of the deaths that he caused by his decision to put COVID positive nursing home patients back into nursing homes. And then it spread like wildfire there. Naturally, you could own that decision, but that might threaten your book deal or future book deals and your credibility as this COVID savior. That's what should be the primary focus. Not that this isn't legitimate, but there are bodies. There are dead body counts, you know, thousands and thousands that are attributable to his decision making there.
I mean, I think to a certain extent, there's sort of like that we're going to get Al Capone on taxes type of situation where it, you know, there are certain we are now in the realm of politics that I think the salience of the way that he treated people had more resonance with the public, for better or for worse. But I agree with you. Certainly what he did with the nursing homes, incredibly egregious. All right. Well, that's it for us today. We'll talk more about it tomorrow. We will see you then. Unless we see you now. And not only will you see Emma and I now.
Hello.
But moving into the Zoom playing field.
Yes, the Zoom playing field.
The Zoom.
There he is. That's what it's called, Sam. The official word, the Zoom playing field.
The Zoom playing field. Brandon Sutton. Brandon's going to join us for the fun half, ladies and gentlemen. Brandon, welcome.
Oh, and thank you for having me, Sam. Tardy.
Let's go through. You're tardy? No, you're right on time.
Oh, that's great then. I'm not sorry.
Brandon, why don't you tell us what's coming up on your podcast?
Well, you know, my podcast, we like to stay fresh, loose, casual, you know, not just casual Friday, but casual Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. Sam, you know, and Emma and Matt and Brendan. So coming up on my podcast, you know, we do a Twitch stream every morning. One of my co-hosts, John, does a Twitch stream. So check that out for a little bit of the daily news. And, you know, coming
what's
up
the address of that Twitch stream, Brandon?
I believe it's the same as the Twitter account, The Discourse, but the first E is a 3, not because it's cool, but because someone had already taken the E.
Right.
So,
okay.
You know, it happens. It happens. So we're expanding, is what I'm telling you, is what I'm trying to say, Sam. You know,
congratulations.
Coming into the second quarter of the, you know, 2021, we're going to try to expand.
All right. Well, then I'll give you one of these. Don't forget to check out Nomi's show streaming today at 3 p.m. The Nomi Key show on YouTube.com or on Twitch.tv, the_NomiKey_show. And Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lekian media empire?
Tomorrow night on Left Reckoning, Victor Pugy, formerly of The Intercept Brazil, who worked on the Luke's that helped blow up the Lava Jato investigation, will be joining David and I for about an hour to discuss Lula and Bolsonaro and all that good stuff. So it's a really great interview. We actually recorded it yesterday. You'll want to check that out. Tomorrow night, 8 Eastern, Left Reckoning YouTube channel, patreon.com/Left Reckoning.
All right, and let me just say this before we go to the fun half. Got an IM. Hi, MR crew. Longtime listener and member since 2015. Every year, I am asking for a birthday shofar, but have never gotten one. Am I ignored on purpose? What does a middle-aged woman have to do? Is this ageism? Since Sam and I are the same age, it does make me wonder. Signed, not Karen. Well, here is a shofar for not Karen. See you in the fun half. Oh, that's awkward.
RM for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half. Sent us this.
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Almost says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back, back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Danarchy song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danarchy.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, fuck! Fuck you, reminder!
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are
psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Almost says what?
What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What?
Almost says what?
Hell out of the bank. Hell out of the bank. Hell out of the bank. Hell out of the bank.
All lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black. African. And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black. Black, 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 black.
You see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Cannot hustle.
Come on! Fuck them, fuck them, fuck them. Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are back. Africans are black, black.
Come on!
What?
Come on!
What?
Come on!
Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy, 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 pussy.